Thinking Sideways is not brought to you by spam emails about spam protection. No, instead, it's brought to you by CrimeCon 2018. That's right, CrimeCon is back. This year, it's going to be in Nashville, Tennessee, on May 4th through the 6th. That's a weekend, thank God. There are going to be lots of famous people you've heard of and seen on TV. There's going to be true crime authors, real police type persons and retired police type persons and all kinds of stuff like that. Plus podcasters. Yeah, we're going to be there for one thing. And of course, it's going to be in Nashville. So that's a cool town. That's going to be fun right in and of itself. So come and see us. We'll probably have a meetup too. So go to crimecon.com, use the promo code SIDEWAYS, and you will get 10% off your ticket price. So remember that, crimecon.com, promo code SIDEWAYS. Thinking Sideways podcast is also brought to you by the audiobook edition of The Wife Between Us by Greer Hendricks and Sarah Pekkanen. Yes, you now can hear the story. Listeners are calling, wow, just wow, and one of the best audiobooks ever. Here's what the New York Times book review said, quote, a fiendishly smart cat and mouse thriller, unquote. Sounds like something I might just read myself, or better still, I'll pick up the audiobook and listen to it. It is narrated by Julia Whalen. It's twisty psychological suspense about a jealous wife, but it's not what you think it is. So start listening now at MacmillanAudio.com/wifebetweenus.
Well, hey there, and welcome again to another episode of Thinking Sideways. I am Steve, joined as usual by...
Devin!
And Joe!
Woo!
Hey.
And this week, once again, we're going to talk about a mystery, but as I said last week, we are not going to talk about the same kind of mystery that we've been talking about for several weeks in a row, which is the gory, gross kind.
Yeah, we're going to do that thing that we do because we're a podcast about unsolved mysteries, not true crime, and talk about something that's like a mystery.
And this is totally not gory. It does involve somebody getting shot to death.
But there's no crime.
Yeah, there is no crime.
But maybe there is
no mystery.
No mystery. Yeah. No, the only thing there is a mystery.
Okay, yeah. No, right. Actually, if it depends on who you ask. I mean, and some people consider the entire Spanish Civil War to be a huge crime.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Okay. Well, listen, here's the deal is today's mystery is entirely centered around the authenticity of a photograph that is commonly known as the Falling Soldier. And this photo, which you've probably seen, was taken in 1936 and shows a Republican soldier during the Spanish Civil War who's in mid-fall after supposedly having been shot and killed.
And here's the thing is I had never, ever seen this photo.
Yes, you
had. I don't think I had.
It's supposedly like one of the most famous war photos ever taken.
Great. Here's what I'm telling you as a sovereign human is that I genuinely never seen this photo before. And if you have not.
If you are like Devin, stop now.
Yeah. Pause, go look it up.
Go look up The Falling Soldier by Robert Capa.
Or check out our website, thinkingsidewayspodcast.com.
Ooh,
there will be a picture right
there,
too.
That's a good point. Yep. Yeah.
So let's give you the mystery here. Let's give you a little description. So our soldier, he's wearing a white shirt. He's got light-colored pants on. He's got this really distinct set of ammunition bags with suspenders holding them up on his shoulders. And he's falling backwards, his knees are bent, his right arm is fully outstretched. He's got a rifle in his hand.
Yeah, he's dropping his rifle.
Dropping or flinging it away from himself. But his body is twisting to the left away from where the photographer is.
Did the rifle have a bayonet on it?
No.
Okay.
No, it did not. But he is turning away.
That's not a stupid question.
No,
right?
No.
That
no,
was
no,
a thing.
Not actually.
Yeah, that was a thing during that time.
Okay. Oh, it's it was. Still cool. Is technically.
You don't fix bayonets till you're ready for the charge, though.
Right.
Yeah. But no, he's twisting away, and his head is turned also to the left, away from the photographer. And people say that he has just either been shot in the chest or shot in the head, and that this photo has literally captured him in the moment that he dies. dies. So that's what really gets everybody up, is like, this is such an amazingly such an amazing capture by a photographer,
and captured in an extremely random way also. Yeah, but you've heard the story of how
we'll talk about that shortly. I want to tell everybody who took the photo first. It was taken by a photo actually very, very famous now today, well-known photographer, and beginning then, he was a beginning photojournalist.
He just started out,
and that's a guy by the name of Robert Capa. And to this day, though, people say, listen, Capa really did take that photo in the conditions he said, or no, that photo was a fake and it's not real, even though, as Joe said, it's considered one of the best photos from a war.
And by fake, it's, you know, I know your minds are going, I think it's been photoshopped, but no, just this guy pretended to get shot.
Right, he didn't actually get killed in the circumstances that are described surrounding the photo.
So that's the mystery.
Was it a fake or was it real? Not?
Yeah. Photoshop?
Yeah.
Weird AI monster?
No. Nope, none of those. None of those two, Devin.
Alien?
None of that.
Chupacabra?
Maybe.
Maybe.
Okay.
But probably not.
Okay.
So let's start at the beginning here. Let me give you a little bit about Robert Capa, and then we'll move into the situation that leads him to be where he was to take the photo. Capa was originally, he was born with the name Andre Friedman. He was born in Budapest, 1913. And he was Jewish, and that would be something that would push him across Europe and eventually to the New World, to the Americas, based on the political climates in Europe at the time.
I bet.
He left Hungary when he was accused of being a communist sympathizer, which he would then say, okay, well, I got to get out of here. Like, literally, they said,
I'm going to go to Germany.
Well, they said, listen, if you get out of town in 24 hours and don't come back to the country, we won't do anything to you. So he had the bad fortune of choosing Germany.
Well, that's kind of close by.
Well, actually, I wouldn't say, you know, as I say that, it's not bad fortune, because that is where he was able to learn and perfect some of his trade, which is photography, and it actually is what launched his career.
I mean, the other option there is, right, that maybe he, like, actually was a Nazi and, like, intentionally moved to Germany, and like, later in life was like, ah, it was a mistake.
No. He was definitely against what the Nazis stood for, so that is definitely not
great.
But
I'm not sure how many Jews were pro-Nazi.
Not too many.
Fair enough.
And nobody's ever heard from them again. Mm-hmm. But no, so he went there. He stayed in Germany for about 2 years, where he learned his craft. And then he left in 1933, and he moved to Paris.
Where the Germans will never get him.
Well, yeah.
Well, that was that thing about that war, though, right? Is that, like, you could pretty much move almost anywhere in
the Germans
Europe.
Would catch up with
him. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
So he gets to Germany. He meets a bunch of other immigrants there who are also become these huge names in photography. But while he's there, he meets this woman, and her name is, I listened to her name so many times and I know I'm going to mess it up and I apologize. It is Gerda Pohorl. I believe that's how you say it. And if I apologize, again, I apologize if I mispronounce it. Like I said, I listened to it on a documentary a bunch of times, and I couldn't quite get it.
She's dead, so she can't complain.
Well, no, that's heartless. But the point is here, she and Andre Friedman meet. They're both photographers. They're trying to sell photos and get jobs, but they're not really making any money. And she comes up with this brilliant scheme. She's the one that kind of makes Robert Capa, because here's what she figures out, is that as a Jewish man, he is having a very hard time because there's prejudices and people just don't want to pay money for photos from this run-of-the-mill photo guy anyway. But if they say, and this is what they do, they say, listen, there's actually this very famous photographer named Robert Capa from America, and he's here, and I'm negotiating on his behalf, and it would be an insult for you to not pay him X amount for his photos. Well, his photos were good enough. They're like, we'll go ahead. We'll bring us this job, and they got it, and they get paid. It.
I feel like they
pulled the whole thing off.
I really
feel like this, like, speaks so deeply to me, because I have this, like, deep seated belief that, like, women by and large, are the ones who like hustle. We are the ones who like come up with these amazing like business schemes and really like hustle to make things happen.
That's sexist.
And oftentimes it's, I mean, yeah, but oftentimes it is to, you know, build up somebody that you care about, often like a man that you care about. But regardless, I just like, this speaks to me on such a deep level that she was just like, no, you know what we should do is just lie about it.
Well, but at the same time, though, she
it's amazing.
She reinvented herself, though, because she changed her name to Gerda Taro at the same time and started pitching her photos as well. And so she was selling stuff. The long story is, or the short version of this, though, is that it works. They start making money. It
Which
funds
is great.
Their travels.
Yeah.
They start getting commissions. One of the things that they do is they realize that there's this civil war starting in Spain, and they have this naive idea of they want to capture war on film and show the, you know, what's happening to the people and things that you just didn't see. Because war traditionally was only pictures snapped of like the generals, the bigwigs talking and having conferences and not the guy in the trench bleeding to death.
So why do you classify that as a naive idea?
Because the way I've understood it is that it's that very young idea of we're going to go and it's going to be beautiful and nothing's going to happen and no bad things are going to happen.
And instead they end up in the trenches.
I guess it doesn't work out
in the long run to be a wonderful, beautiful, artistic experience. It becomes very dirty and visceral.
That wasn't necessarily the sense that I had. I mean, they both came from kind of war-torn places.
That's very true.
And they understood the idea of feeling like it was important to capture the realities of those wars.
I guess idealist would be a better way to explain what I'm trying to say.
I guess it feels to me like they were making a very conscious decision to go in. I mean, a lot of journalists do this too right now, where they make this conscious decision to go in because they think it's important that it's not just the generals in their pretty uniforms in their beautiful rooms
with their oak tables.
Right. And that everybody should know what war actually looks like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, yes, it's maybe a little naive to assume that bad things won't happen to them or that it's going to be fun and beautiful. But I think it's my sense that they had at least a pretty realistic idea of what a war-torn place looked like.
Well, they had the personalities for it.
This is also not a new idea. I mean, ever since photography began, people have been taking pictures of war.
Yeah.
Not a new idea.
Absolutely.
But I do think that as a war correspondent, you do have the luxury of being able to pop in, take some pictures,
and
make
leave.
Some notes, interview, and then leave.
Yeah.
You know, which is not something the guys in the trenches get to do.
True.
No.
That's the really horrible thing about war, well, besides getting your arms and legs blown off, you know, but it's just living in these awful conditions for weeks, months, maybe
but
even
see, that
years,
was that was the you know? Eventually that would be the thing that distinguished Robert Capa so much, is that he would pop into a trench or a foxhole, sit there and smoke a cigarette and talk to a guy, a kid who is freaking the F out because he is
an
everything is exploding.
Yeah.
He's calm as the day, you know, blowing up all around him. He's just having a conversation. Kid's able to kind of focus in. Like, I've watched documentaries of these people. Like, he was amazing. Like, this stuff didn't... Mm-hmm. Stuff is not the word I wanted to use.
But
it
didn't
faze him. Yeah. He just... So he had that kind of
Which is why I kind of had that sense of, like, they knew what they were getting into.
See, and,
I mean,
yeah,
they had
I don't
seen
know how
a lot
of that
of...
is developed naturally.
Sure. And that could again be like a 2020 impression of them. They could have gone into it totally blind and it just happened that they were good at it.
Uh-huh.
They could have been like, this is going to be beautiful and amazing. It's going to be like Woodstock all over again.
Okay,
well,
so
there is such a thing. Actually, there's been some beautiful war photography. It's
really
hauntingly
beautiful, but beautiful. Yeah.
So like I said, though, let's get back into this part of the story, or the beginning of what leads up to the falling soldier.
Yeah, I guess.
Is that they get this commission, and I believe it's View magazine, which is a French magazine. They get a commission. They go to Spain to check out the war, and I'm going to give you the loosest basic primer on what the Spanish Civil War was.
They were shooting at each other.
There is tons of information out there, and if you want to dive deep into this, do so. It's very interesting, but it's not our total focus here.
Yeah.
But basically,
the disclaimer here is basically like, this is not a podcast about the Spanish Civil War. Mm.
So the simple version is between the late 19-teens to the 1930s, in Spain, there's a series of political upheavals. The monarchy becomes unpopular and unstable, and things like communism and socialism and right-wing fascism start gaining ground. Eventually, everybody is pissed off at everybody else. Like, it's just dirty and not good. And there's some unsuccessful coups in the early 30s. And then there is one that goes off literally with a bang, and everybody is at each other's throats, and the country divides into two parties. There's the Republicans, which are called the Popular Front, and the Nationalists, who are the anti-communists, and they go at it for, I think, three years.
36 to 39.
Yeah, about 3 years is how long the Spanish Civil War lasted.
Yeah.
That is the basic, most basic of...
Yeah.
That's like not even the Wikipedia intro to the article.
Oh, no, I cooked this puppy down.
Actually, if you want any reading on it, George Orwell took part in the war. He was in the trenches.
George Orwell, the film director?
George Orwell, the writer.
Oh, the writer. 1984. Sorry.
Yeah, he wrote Orwellian. But he wrote a book about his experiences called Homage to Catalonia.
Okay.
Which is a pretty good read. As it pains to say, he doesn't talk about it completely. He talks about his corner of the war, the things that he saw, but also tries to explain some of the overarching groups and what they were all about and stuff. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't claim that he explains the entire thing in total detail.
But it seems almost impossible to do that.
The Spanish Civil War is extremely complicated.
Of really any war.
But it's one of the more complicated ones out there.
Well, because it's the first one where not only is the country fighting itself, but this is where the bigger European powers like the USSR, the communist nation, and the Germans and the Americans, like all these different forces are starting to push stuff in. It's described as a testing ground for what would become World War II.
There was a lot of international interference. A lot of people came from far and wide to participate on both sides of the war. Again, like Orwell, for example, Ernest Hemingway was another one, and there's some other famous figures you could name.
Yeah.
Tons of people fought in that war, and it's also, I think, unique, or at least the first war really that is totally shrouded in clouds of BS. I mean, there's a lot of BS surrounding this war that really has followed us down to this to the present day.
Well, I can't disagree with you, because I wanted to have, as you guys know, I've done this before. I'm going to give you a 2.5 to 3 paragraph description of this war. And as I read it, it just became more convoluted. So that is a great description of the problems with explaining this conflict.
Well, yeah, and I don't mean that the people of the war was BS. I just mean a lot of the commentary afterwards, interpretations. That people have put on the war and the people fighting it and everything else are mostly BS.
And so with that, let's move forward, because I think the one pertinent bit of information about the Spanish Civil War is when it began, because that plays into the date of the capture of the image of the falling soldier. The war began in July 1936. Mm. Okay, we're going to move in, and supposedly the photo of the falling soldier was taken in September. We don't know when in September, but in September of 1936. There's some things that can kind of maybe help us figure that out. The first of which is when the photo ran, the original run date of it. Because if you remember, I said there was Vue magazine back in Paris.
Mm-hmm. And Vue is VU.
Yeah. VU, correct.
Not VU,
not VIEU.
Yeah, it's not like the VU, like.
Yeah, no, that's a different show entirely with four women on it. No, they were not there. This magazine would run the image along with quite a few other of Robert Capa's images in the September 23rd, 1936 issue.
Yeah, so he
suddenly lost the word issue.
So he took it at least no later than that morning, then, and then immediately downloaded it to the internet, found himself in the internet cafe.
Well, no,
made the edits.
There is no internet. There is no editing. He had to hand off undeveloped negatives to a pilot who would then fly them back to Paris, where they would go to a dark room, get developed, and then get integrated in the magazine.
And
so there's got to be at least days.
And
I'm using that loosely.
Sure, and that's the corroborated. that was the process.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't ever see his own. I mean, he didn't develop on site.
No, he couldn't.
He did have. I think back in Paris, he had a.
He did have a dark room.
He had
Paris.
His dark room. He yeah, but.
But he was still in Spain when the
taking
image
pictures.
Ran.
Yeah.
Probably. With taking that. Pictures, presumably.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Presumably. Yeah.
Right. But so, I mean, that's kind of a frustrating little detail in this, right? Is that, I mean, we've all everybody in this room, at least, has shot film.
Uh-huh.
With a camera.
Yeah.
A film
you
camera.
You gotta wait for it to come back.
Well, and that you, like, kind of, you stick it in your tube, and you say, like, I mean, like, how much can you say about it? You can't ever go through, especially if you don't have a dark room, right? You don't have the chance to go through and say, like, frame one, roll one. This is where I took it. Frame two, roll one. This
okay,
is where
so
I took
actually,
it.
Okay, so actually, a counter to that is because, as you two know, I'm in a photography class right now because I shoot all the time.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I don't do, because digital makes this so much easier, but this instructor is really, really pressing on us, and he is old school, mm-hmm. Very old school, is you have a notebook, you write down your shot numbers and your exposure time and your f-stop and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Now, as a war photographer, you can't do that because you
definitely
are just
not.
Blazing away, but you can stop and write, roll 215, this date, this event. Like, you can give
I'm sure they did keep track. It's not like today where you can actually just go to the image and look in the data and there it is, your
right.
f-stop and your lens.
Right.
Everything
I mean,
right.
I'm sure
yeah.
that there was yeah. some taken place, but, you know, this image particularly that we're talking about and the kind of photography he was doing, we're talking like actual battlefield,
correct.
Like bullets flying over your head photography. Mm. So
yes.
I presume that he wasn't also like picture, snap. Okay.
Notebook.
Okay. Picture, snap. Notebook. No, I mean,
no.
You know, you have to kind of take that back.
Correct.
And so that's something else that I would just
yes.
add or to the layer, add to
like,
the layer of complexity.
More like on a roll basis. You
yes.
know, like
right.
Label,
yes.
label the can of the roll and then
right.
make a note of where.
Right.
Word
and so that's
date,
that added
you know?
Complexity of us not actually having him saying
mm-hmm.
to the publisher, this is what I got.
Well, and here's the other problem is there's the influence or the input of the publisher of the photos.
Oh, for sure.
Because at the time that it runs in view, they say that the photo was taken in Cordoba, Spain, but other people have come along after the fact and said, oh no, that was taken in Cerro Muriano, I believe is how you pronounce that city's name. Now, that might not sound like a big deal because those two cities are about 8 miles or 12 kilometers apart. But if there's a war, that could actually be pretty important.
Yes.
And as we'll find later on, there's even more locations
yeah.
that are suggested where this photo might have been taken. So that draws it out to not 8 miles and 12 kilometers, but 30 miles and what is that, like 80 kilometers roughly difference? I mean, this
yeah.
can be huge differences in where the battlefront is. So
yes,
that also yeah. throws, you know, question of was he taking it in a serene place or was it somewhere where all hell was breaking loose?
Mm.
For his part, Robert Capa never really talked about this photo and what the circumstances around it. He's really kind of tight-lipped around it, which was weird because he was such an outgoing and very fun and playful man is
I have
the way
a few,
that he's described.
I'll talk about all the few different reasons, I
okay.
guess, probably in
theories. Yeah, I have some ideas too. But according to him, in one of the few interviews that he did, what he said was... Actually, Joe, do you mind reading this?
Yeah, sure.
This seems right up your alley, my friend.
Do I have to do it with a Hungarian accent?
No, just do it as
Please
you.
Please don't, in fact. Yeah.
I'm sure it'll offend all our Hungarian listeners. Quote, I was there in the trench with about 20 milicianos. I just kind of put my camera above my head and didn't even look and click the picture when they moved over the trench. And that was all. That camera, which I held above my head, just caught a man at the moment when he was shot. That was probably the best picture I ever took. I never saw the picture in the frame because the camera was far above my head, unquote.
No, that's amazing because what you need to realize is that he's shooting, at this time, 35 millimeter film has become available. So that's great because it's highly portable. He's using a Leica camera, which is more akin to the body style of a camera you see today than mm-hmm. the old school Boxer Brownie style. So it makes it's amazing to think that he held it up and it was as in focus as it was.
Very, very lucky for him, yeah.
It's an amazingly lucky shot, which is yeah. also why people question it.
Well, yeah. He You probably had it stopped way down. You know, I mean, the smaller the aperture.
Yeah, then, just
you know,
wide open to get as much light. But still, that focus ring is the hardest bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if there was a lot of action happening. I don't know as much about photography as either of you do, certainly. But
yeah, we won't develop into nerd talk.
It's fine. Yeah. But I would just say that, like, you know, if he had focused from the trench on kind of where the front line was happening and then had to duck down because shooting was happening and was just reaching up, that might account for, in my understanding of photography, might account for why it was so in focus. But again, it was pretty lucky.
Yeah, it's pretty 100% lucky. In focus.
I didn't think it was perfectly in focus, personally.
But no, it was pretty in focus.
Other photos from that series that are in much better focus. But we'll deal with that shortly. Let's move to after the fact, though. So Kappa takes his shot. He would then eventually leave Spain, because remember, this war goes on for years, and he would bounce back and forth to Spain over the course of that war. Unfortunately, when he left, Gerda didn't want to go. She got another assignment, and she stayed, and that would end up costing her her life. If you've never heard of the story, you don't know this, is they were lovers. They had a intimate relationship, and when she was killed, it took a toll on him. She was in another battle area. She jumped onto a jeep or some kind of vehicle that was moving away, and a tank rolled into it, and she didn't die that moment, but she died the next day.
Man, that's somehow even worse.
Okay, yeah. So the tank just hit it, or tank rolled right over the top
of it? I believe that the tank hit it, she was thrown to the ground, and probably the car rolled on top of her, because she was riding on the running board of the vehicle.
Yeah.
So I have a feeling that she took massive internal injuries, which took about a day to kill her. So she is actually considered to be probably the first female photojournalist to have ever died in a battlefield or war situation. Yeah. So not the title that you want, but you know, she earned that
but
title.
Fairly prestigious.
Absolutely.
I mean, one that you actively aim for, but,
no.
at least but one that you can be respected for.
Yeah, at least people are going to look at you and say, wow, what a dumb, ignominious death, you know?
She was trying to get it
really
done.
Really trying, yeah.
And for his part, Robert Capa would go on. He would photograph every major conflict from then until his death in 1954. He got an assignment for Life magazine to take photographs at the end of the first Indochina War. This is in Vietnam. It's not the actual Vietnam War. The designation for being the Vietnam War takes about another year or so, but
Vietnam War, the French were there. Like,
yeah, this is when the French were being pushed out. Yeah. And
I mean, that was still the Vietnam War, same war.
It was in Vietnam, yes, but it's got the designation of the first and the second Indochina Wars.
Yeah.
But the point is, he's there, he's taking photos of the troops, and at one point he says he's going to go ahead and take photos back down the track they're walking. He steps on a landmine, and that takes his life. Oh, and that is the end of Robert Capa. The man is well known, though. If you've ever seen photos of the Omaha Beach in D-Day, he's the one who took those photos. He dove off of a boat with all of these Marines and soldiers in the thick of it, and he took photos the whole time. I think he shot like 120 or 140 images that day. Only 11 of them survived because, unfortunately, when he sent his film to the UK to get developed, a film tech screwed up and destroyed all but those 11 iconic images that we have.
Oopsie. Amazing photos.
Still, probably the ones that got destroyed were even more iconic.
Or like
even
equally,
more
at least.
Yeah. Yes. So he's very well known. He is the standard of war photography. And if you've, like I said, you've probably seen his work. You just didn't know who he was. Okay. So back to the falling soldier. 25 years go by. Everybody has taken the story of this photo at face value. Nobody has really said, nah, that can't be right.
Well, I mean, you know, was the time.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. But then in the 70s, a book comes out and somebody says, I don't know if I think that's really real, but we don't have anything to corroborate it. And then an amazing thing happens, which is, remember we said he fled, he left Paris because the Nazis were coming?
Yeah.
Well, when he did, he left his darkroom, he left all of his film and his negatives there, and he had a suitcase with three boxes of developed film in those boxes. Somehow, through some series of events, that suitcase made its way into a diplomat's hands. That diplomat took the suitcase to Mexico, where it lived for the next 70-some years until such time as a bargain was struck and that film was brought forward and given to the Kappa Estate and Magnum Photos. And Magnum is the company that he helped start with three other well-known photographers back in the... That would be in the 30s that he did that.
Yeah.
But they developed all of the... Or they created prints off of all of that cellulose. And it was amazing that it was still viable. Because if you remember, film degrades over time.
Especially back in the older days. Yeah, it's so not as stable as it is today.
So it was amazing that this stuff was in really good shape. And they got a whole bunch of images from his time in Spain. The image of the falling soldier is not in that set. But what is in there is some other images that he took at the same time. And it helps paint maybe a timeline of where he was and what was going on when that particular photo was shot. Thus, even more questions are asked. It was amazing is that not only were his photos found in that suitcase, Gerda's photos, some of hers were also found. And a man by the name of David Seymour, who had a really colorful nickname that I forgot, but can't remember his name. I loved his nickname, but I've forgotten it. But all these lost images of theirs from that war were found, which is wonderful. But now what we're left with is we have more information, we have more images, but it's an incomplete record. And the question here is, was the falling man truly taken in a conflict, or was it not, and it was a staged image? That's what we're going to talk about now that we're in theories. But first, let's take a quick break.
Hey, Hulu has got a new original series coming out. It's called The Looming Tower. It's based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning book by Lawrence Wright. It is about, guess what, all the events leading up to the 9/11 attacks. The series on Hulu traces the rising threat of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and how the rivalry and the bureaucratic infighting between the FBI and the CIA might have prevented us from actually heading off those attacks. The Looming Tower stars Jeff Daniels, I'm sure you heard of him, also Peter Sarsgaard and Tahar Rahim. And so The Looming Tower is available now, but only on Hulu. Go watch it.
Click, and we're back.
Shim.
It was Shim. Yes, it was Shim. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So now that we know who it is,
yeah, sorry.
Let's get into the first theory.
I took all half hour of our break to Google that.
Oh, I know you did. Okay, no. So here, we've actually got really three basic theories. The first theory is that the photograph is authentic in the sense that it is,
it was taken the way they said.
Yeah, there is no cover story around the whole thing. And it is somebody being killed or at the moment of death from being shot with a bullet.
Yeah, it's not that outlandish that you go to a war zone and you manage to get a picture of somebody getting shot. You know,
it happens a lot.
I bet it does.
Yeah.
It happens in the war zones really often.
Sorry, people getting shot in war zones happens a lot.
Yes.
Pictures of people getting shot in war zones
is harder.
Less. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The timing is tricky. Yeah.
Okay, so if we follow this theory though, Kappa's biographers and the guys at Magnum Photos, which again, like I said earlier, was a company he founded, they all say that the photo is the real deal. And there's a man by the name of Richard Whalen. I believe Whalen is still alive, but I swore I saw something that said he actually passed away within the last 2 or 3 years. But he was a biographer of Kappa. And what Waylon did, this was back at, this was like around 2000, before the suitcase of images had been found.
Now, was he the guy that wrote the article for the PBS or something? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the same guy.
Right.
I remember that one.
PBS,
yeah.
Stop putting your articles on black backgrounds. Yeah. But yeah. He enlisted the help of a homicide detective.
Was it Steve Hodell?
No.
Just kidding.
No. I was like, wait a minute, what? No. Wasn't Hodell. I can't remember the guy's name. Is it in here? We'll find it. But the point is, this detective said, yeah, sure, I'll look at the photo. That's cool. I've seen a lot of things in my line of work as a homicide detective.
Mm-hmm.
And what he noticed and he pointed out was in the image, the soldier's left hand is barely visible. Now, remember, I said the man is twisting and falling backwards, and he's twisting to his left away from the photographer. And his left hand is barely visible. His legs are bent, and that hand, you can see it dropping below his left thigh. Well, the fingers on that hand are curling. They're curling inwards.
In a relaxed way, not like making a fist kind of way.
Correct. They're just kind of loose. Like, you know, when you fall asleep and you wake up and your hand is just kind of loosely curled.
Say, like, when you shake your hands out?
Yeah, something just like that. Okay, well, he said, listen, most people, when they are falling backwards intentionally, they cannot help but reflexively put their hand out to break their fall.
Or accidentally falling backwards.
Yes. Yeah,
anybody who's aware of the fact that they are falling backwards.
It's an automatic reaction.
Yes.
But when you are shot, or well, actually, more importantly, when you are deceased, the tension in your muscles and your whole body go out, and the hands automatically curl inward. And he keyed in on that, saying, listen, I think the guy is actually dead already as he's falling to the ground. And this is a symptom of it, that his hand is curling in on itself. Okay, that makes total sense, but I have a total issue with it because I'm still struggling with the photo sequence, which we're going to talk about some more soon.
Well, another issue is the lack of a bullet hole anywhere.
Well, they say that he shot in the head, and remember I said that if you look at this photo, his left, basically the left side of his head, you can't really see in the image.
I suppose, actually, if he was sort of shot in the left side of the head, that would explain why he's twisting
in that
left
direction.
Yeah,
totally. Like, he could have been shot in the heart and twisting. His white shirt would not show blood yet, because it is just the moment of impact and he is initially twisting, that flow of blood from everything being cut by the bullet is not going to show up.
He could have been shot left back side of his head too, through his, because he has black hair.
Uh-huh.
Right? So it could have been shot in his head. Sorry, I'm going away from Mike. And his head just, like, you know, flung with the velocity of to the right. There's a lot of ways.
There's a lot of ways that this bullet could have impacted him to kill him and make his body turn in the method that it did.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that they are pointing to at Magnum, and Mr. Whalen has also pointed out, was he was looking at the timing of the photograph of the falling soldier and when it was released. There's a guy, he's a contemporary of Robert Capa. His name is Hans Namath. And Namath was in Spain at the same time as Capa, doing the same thing, doing war journalism. And by the way, you also, this is another one, I'm name dropping again. Oh. This is also a photographer you know. You know who Jackson Pollock is? He's the drip artist from the 50s, the famous guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I remember that guy.
There's iconic photos of Jackson Pollock at work, and those photos were taken by Hans Namath. So you actually know his work as well, even if you didn't realize it.
Yeah. You probably have.
You're right. I forget. I spent so many years in school in the arts that I forget sometimes that not everybody has seen.
Oh, God, no. Yeah.
Like, they're just, I instantly had that. Like, oh, yeah, I know who that is even before I pulled up the image.
Yeah.
I knew who it was.
And that, you know that image.
Yes.
Yeah.
I knew that image of him bent over the canvas on the floor.
Me too.
Doing his drip painting.
I also went to art school, so.
Yes. Okay. Hans Nemeth was near a village. This is, you know, in September of 36, early September of 36. He's in the village of Cerro Muriano when the fighting broke out on the 5th and the 6th of September. And he took a bunch of photographs of the local villagers fleeing from that violence. And he mm-hmm. went on record and said, "No, I never saw Robert Capa or Gerda at any time while I was there." And yet, images of those same fleeing villagers were run along with the image of the falling soldier in View magazine. So
taken by Capa?
By Capa, yeah. So it says, wait, Robert Capa was there. And everybody said the image of the falling soldier was shot, was taken on the 5th or the 6th, because that was when the conflict happened at that location.
Hmm.
So that, along with the last thing that Richard Wayland found, which is that the original prints that they dug up, you know, Kappa's prints, they were sequentially numbered. That's the, from when they were originally developed.
Hmm. Yeah.
And the numbers on the back of the falling soldier print is prior to the fleeing villager prints.
Hmm.
So they're saying, listen, he was there. We know he was there because other photographers have the same people in their images, in their photographs. And this sequential numbering is showing that this had to have all been done prior to those villagers' images being captured. So that's a timeline that they've established using those bits of information.
The really cynical part of me says, yeah, that film was there.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Somebody else took the pics?
I mean, like, you know, who knows who had a camera and was willing to sell Robert Capa some film.
Actually, I don't think Capa bought anybody.
I don't actually think that, but there is.
You actually bring up a very interesting point. This is a theory that I didn't have in here, but we'll just toss this out there as a also floating theory.
Yeah.
Which is that Robert Capa didn't take the photo, but you know who did? Gerda.
Yeah.
Because they had made a moniker. I think it was Capa and Taro is the translation of it. They had stamps made up. Like, that was just their brand. They worked so closely together that there is questions of some of those early photos of which one took them.
Right.
Now, he had a very distinct style, but if you are taking photographs with someone all the time and you're reviewing your work together, you tend to just naturally pick up.
Yeah, if you're co-developing a style.
Right.
I mean, they're co-developing a brand,
absolutely,
basically.
Right.
You know?
And so maybe.
And that's one of those things, too, where it's kind of like she was the first woman to die on a battlefield as a photojournalist. Like, maybe her legacy is even broader than we necessarily know if it is true that she took these pictures, but that they just thought it would sell better.
They attributed
better.
It to Robert
Capa
rather
sells
than
better.
Her, because he's a man. Again, it's the era.
Yeah.
This is not me being sexist. This is the era being sexist.
Well, I mean, it's not just
the
era.
It's not
just the era being sexist. It's the era being super racist, because obviously he wasn't even selling photos as a Jew in that time either. He had to change his entire identity.
A Hungarian Jew.
That.
Yeah. He had to change his own identity, let alone her having to also change all her identity.
True that. But do you know if Gerda was even there that day?
No.
She was there with Capa. They traveled together. They apparently were inseparable when they were in Spain.
Oh, okay.
So the information that I have found, it wasn't as if they said, hey, I'm going to go here and you go there and let's meet up next week in this other town. No, they went everywhere together. I think it was Hans Nemeth was talking about the fact, like, they ran out of cover at one point to watch a plane that had been shot down spiraling. And it was him or somebody else just talking about, like, their general level of almost naivete about, like, oh, this and that, and we're going to do this with our photos, and, like, this just this general. I mean, remember.
I would say brazenness.
Well, but remember, he is a very, very young man at this time. He is, like, 20?
Yeah.
18 or 20, something like that. He's a very young guy. He was born in 1918. This is happening. Yeah, he's 18 years old.
Again, I would call that boldness, not necessary, or brazenness, not necessarily like naivete.
The immortality kind of thing.
Yeah, the immortality.
Yeah, there's some of that, but there's also that sort of like this, again, just, you know, knowing kind of what we know from like later interviews and things like that of him, thinking that he probably did think it wasn't just like, I could never die. It was like, this is important and I should capture it, you know? And so that's, I mean, that's hard. Well, it's hard
his motto was amazing. And unfortunately it may have also been what cost him his life, which is, if your photos aren't good enough, you're not close enough.
Yeah. But so that's why I don't think like naivete. I think just like this, like, I mean, you know, brazenness, whatever we want to call it.
You know, I mean, sometimes people are just obsessive about certain things.
And which is also fine.
Which makes them sort of have a little bit of disregard for their safety.
I was listening to an interview with an NPR correspondent recently, and she said, you know, the really interesting thing about being a war correspondent is that I have this really bad behavior, which is like kind of self-destructive, and that it's like I go to Iran during the war and report on it while there's bombs dropping around me. And then I get a reward, which is an actual broadcasting award. And people are rewarding me for this. So my learned behavior is this really dangerous, horrible thing is what makes me really good at my job. Yeah, and so, I think that, you know, that's kind of feeds into that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, the thing about war too, is that most of the bullets miss.
Yeah.
So your odds are actually,
most of them are stormtroopers.
As long as they do.
Yeah. So odds are you can run out there in the battlefield and you won't get shot.
Yeah.
You know?
But I mean, I guess, I don't know. I mean, I would agree. I don't know. I guess we were kind of talking about my stupid theory that, like, well, maybe he didn't actually take the pictures. I think he probably did. I just was kind of throwing that out there.
I think that Robert Capa took the photo, and based on things that we're going to talk about, sadly, I am very conflicted now, because I think that he took the photo, but I think the circumstances are not what they were said to be, and we should probably talk about that, because that's our second theory.
Yeah, I think it's okay to say either he or Greta definitely took the picture.
Gerda.
Sorry.
Not Greta.
Greta?
Her original name was Greta, but she changed it to Gerda. Sure. You were close.
Anyway, sorry.
I think we should call her Greta.
Yeah. I think it's safe for us to say somebody that owned that brand took the picture.
Okay. We'll go with that. Uh-huh. So let's go on to theory number two, which is indeed that the photo is a fake. And by fake, I mean it is not what it is portrayed to be.
It was staged. It was posed.
Yep.
Yeah.
So the process of faking photos, as Joe said, the process of taking photos of war, that happened as soon as people figured out how to take photographs. And right after that, they figured out how to fake photos to get to tell the story that they wanted to tell. They would manipulate the image in such a way so that it told their story, and it didn't matter what else.
It happens in, you know, I mean, it's like, for example, but imagine you're out in the battlefield and you see something really, some really cool thing you'd never seen before, like somebody getting shot and falling down to the ground, and you think, that's not cool, obviously, but that would make a great shot. Unfortunately, you didn't capture that shot. And it's a huge timing thing. If you want to catch somebody right in the act of getting shot, it's a big thing. And so I could see where, at a certain point, you would kind of give up on trying to actually capture that moment and just ask some soldier, slip him a few pesos, and say, dude, would you fall to the ground? Just like, in a war correspondent's mind, it's actually, if he does it in such a way that it looks just like all these other guys that you've seen getting shot, then it's like, hey, you know, I recreated the moment, you know, I wasn't able to capture it.
And the act of staging photos was what a lot of photographers were forced to do during the Spanish Civil War, specifically because of the fact that the photographers were not allowed onto the front line.
Which makes sense.
Yes.
They're not allowed, or else it's a timing thing, like I said.
So here's the crux, or here's the basis of the information that really is throwing this theory forward at this point for a lot of people, is that while Robert Capa was in Cerro Moriano, he did take photos of refugees, those refugees we talked about that Hans had gotten photos of, but at that point, he had not yet taken the photo of the falling soldier. So basically, the photos were out of order when the print house developed them. They put them in the incorrect order. Mm-hmm. And instead, he took that image a day or more later, at several days later, at an entirely different location in a village called Espejo, which is about 30 miles or 50 kilometers south of where he supposedly was. And at that point, when they got to that town, there was literally nothing happening because they had been, on the 5th and the 6th, they were there, there's all this action, and they say we're going to go somewhere else, and they get to that somewhere else, which is Espejo, according to this theory, and nothing's going on. And at this point, they say, well, listen, we're bored. They talk the local soldiers into running some maneuvers for them, because, hey, you'll get your photo taken, and this is the days where getting your photo taken is still a novel thing. So they run these exercises, and if you look at the photos, there's images of the photographer, whoever the photographer is, whether it's Kappa or Taro, are in the trench, and the soldiers are jumping over the trench, and then they're bending over this mound of dirt, quote-unquote firing at the enemy. They're running. They're doing all of these maneuvers. And
they're LARPing.
They're LARPing.
Live action role playing.
And they may have been doing that for the benefit of the camera. And at one point they said, hey, you know what, like Joe said, do you mind just running and getting, getting shot? Yeah.
So one soldier's like there, and another soldier's going, pew, 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 pew.
Yeah, in Spanish. Yes. Pew in Spanish, whatever that is.
I think it's still pew.
Okay. Yeah. Well, but here's the thing, is that if we look at the images that are taken at the same time as the falling soldier, there's some damning images, because there's an image of a man laying on his back with his rifle across his chest. He appears to be deceased, but his arms are kind of folded over his chest in that I'm laying here dead, or somebody's
posed pretending to be.
There's also another man who is falling and appears to, as if he is falling, almost as if he has been shot.
Yeah.
And here's the hardest part about that. There's not a whole lot of other information in the photo. The ground appears to be rather recently cut wheat.
Yeah.
But what you can see is the background.
Way off
in the distance.
Clouds.
You can see some mountains. You can see what looks like some tilled fields and maybe a farmhouse. They're very, very far and hard to see.
Yeah, maybe almost something that maybe possibly could be a lake.
That's actually a field.
It looks like a lake.
Unfortunate thing, right, that you're about to say is that, like, the background of both of these images is almost
identical.
Yeah.
I line them up. You two have seen this image that I put on. My thing is I put stuff into Photoshop and I start toggling back and forth.
And then you post GIFs of it.
And then I give you guys GIFs of these images flipping back and forth. And these images laid on top of each other are almost a perfect match, as if the images were taken almost on the exact same spot.
It's almost like somebody put a camera somewhere and was like, okay, actor one, go. Actor two, go. Actor three, go.
Somebody did put it, it appears to me that the camera was not on the same spot. It was on a tripod. It absolutely did not move.
No,
If you look at the borders and stuff, and the features and the background and the foreground and everything, it appears to me that it was on a tripod.
Yeah. But that's what I mean. Is it literally?
And like Devin said,
I don't think it's on a tripod, because the falling soldier, everything is in motion, and that's hard to do on a tripod.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the second soldier is perfectly crisp.
Yeah, it is crisp.
But either way, it was somebody standing there with a camera, stationary, going, okay, all right, we got a line of soldiers. Now everybody's going to fake being shot. All right, one,
it could have been a competition.
Two, three. Yeah, who can do the best fake?
Yeah.
Who can do it?
And the thing
is cynical, but
the second soldier, the second soldier who appears to be falling down, he's very identifiable when you compare him to the falling soldier, because whereas the falling soldier is in a white shirt and light colored pants, this man is in what they call a boiler suit, basically a jumpsuit. And whereas the falling soldier has his ammo bags on his hip and the suspenders are going over his shoulders, this second guy in the boiler suit, his suspenders almost run up the center of his torso before wying off over each shoulder. So very different. They look different. Yeah. They're holding their guns different. Like,
the thing that's really interesting about these photos is when you were like, oh, I posted a GIF, before I had done any kind of reading or research on this, I was like, oh, there's the real and the fake. Right. Where I thought that second one with the more identifiable one, I mean, because his fatigues look real, worn in, looks like he's done some stuff. His body is just like crumpled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was like, oh.
Oh, the second soldier.
Yeah,
the
second
one that's like
soldier.
Got his arm folded
the not
him.
Famous one. Yeah. I was like, wow, that looks like a human who just got shot and is dead. And then the other one, I was like, wow, that's a really clean outfit.
It was very clean. Well, it might have been his first day in the trenches. You
sure.
never know.
Yeah. But I mean, that was the interesting thing to me about this whole thing was that you posted these pictures, and my immediate thought
was,
well,
here's the fake of the
yeah,
fakes.
Yeah, and at least as, you know, like somebody who knows historical fashion and things like that, was like, oh. There's the costume and there's the original.
So here's the deal is that there's a guy, his name is Jose Manuel Suspergui, I believe is how you say it. He's a university professor in Spain. And what he did is he took these two photos, or he didn't take actually the falling man photo. He took the man laying prone and quote unquote shot and dead and the boiler suit man photo. And he sent those around to people in the area in Spain to try and identify the background. And that's how we have this idea that it is probably in Espejo is where the photo was taken. And the real big problem, because these people are like, oh, yeah, no, I recognize this. And then they got a hold of locals who were, you know, at this point, old men and women at that time and said, oh, yeah, the fighting here, there was early in September, and it wasn't more fighting until the 25th of September. Well, remember, View ran the image on the 23rd of September, so it can't be fighting in Espejo. That really makes a lot of problems then, because if it is that he took that in Espejo, then it appears that there was no conflict.
Yeah.
Which appears that then it does lead a lot of credence to the idea that, oh no, it was...
Maybe.
It was totally staged for the camera.
Or maybe somebody just shot the guy. Wasn't even war related.
That's actually, we're going to get that into our next theory.
Or actually another theory that I like right now is that it didn't mean to stage somebody getting shot. He was actually going to take a portrait of the soldier and he says, back up a little bit.
<He tripped>.
And they said, that's beautiful. I love it. Yeah.
Monty Python. No. And listen, this is, we've said this a couple of times, but this is not the first instance, if indeed this theory is true, of somebody manipulating a photo. You guys probably have seen this photo, you two in the room, but everybody else out there may have as well. There is a photo titled The Valley of the Shadow of Death by Roger Fenton.
Mm-hmm. And also a Coolio song.
What's that? Oh, Coolio song?
Yeah.
It's from 1855, and it's this, it's during, it's the Crimean War, and there's this road, and there is cannonballs all up and down the sides of the road and all over the road itself, and it is just like, what the hell kind of crazy conflict took place here? And that is the photo that became very iconic until later on a sister photograph showed up, which was the same scene from the same location, same angle, everything, except there was no cannonballs on the road.
Did they Photoshop the balls in there?
No, it turns out they took a lot of work for like 100 years or 150 years for people to figure this out. Photoshop is how they figured it out.
Mm.
The photographer did the second photo, the no cannonballs on road photo, and then he and his assistants went out and grabbed cannonballs off of the side of the road and chucked them onto the road, because the military, as they were moving through, had kicked all of the cannonballs out of the way, because you can't have your horses and your carts coming through with these balls in the way. So they pushed them into the ditches. They put them all back on the road, or a bunch of them, to then take this second photo that was obviously much more powerful, because everybody went, oh my gosh, look at that.
Right. Well, and actually, that's totally authentic, because the first balls were on the road, you know, because somebody put them there, and then the second ones were there because somebody put them there. Yeah. So, hey, there you go. And there's another actually really iconic photograph we've all seen. And it's been questioned for about 50 plus years now about whether it was staged or not. And that is the the famous photo of this half a dozen Marines raising the flag on the Iwo Jima in the Pacific in World War II.
Yeah.
And that was and that one's pretty certifiably absolutely not staged, but there were questions about it still for like 50
understandably
plus
years. There's a famous photo of the here in Oregon, the Columbia River Gorge. This was back in the mid 1800s, and there was a photographer. God, I can't remember his name now, but he was using these crazy monstrous plate cameras, like 22 by 30 inch plates. Humongous thing.
Yeah, I've seen some of those pictures. I can't remember the guy's name.
Yeah, I had it written down, and then I moved it, and I lost it. But anyway, he took this great image of the Columbia River Gorge, but he took the first image, and there was a tree in the middle of his photograph that he didn't like. So he went out. He left his camera where it was. He went out. He cut the tree down, and then he took the picture again.
And the second one
is what we all know. Yeah. Like, this is something that happened from day one.
Oh, yeah. And I was just going to say that, like, I guess from, like, a, again, historical fashion kind of clothing standpoint, one of the first things I did when I saw this picture was, like, all right, what did a Spanish Civil War uniform look like?
These guys were militia.
Yeah.
They weren't actually enlisted soldiers. They were militia. So if you see the photo, there's some of them that look to be in uniform. Mm-hmm. And then there's a bunch of them that aren't.
Weren't.
And
by the way,
they're just in clothes.
They really weren't exactly two neat sides, like two armies.
No, certainly that's true.
In this war?
No, certainly true. But, you know, like, what were the clothes? What were the general uniforms of people at that time? Yeah. And that's the other thing that's like really hard to tell is like, I can't even tell what this image is supposed to be even representing. Mm-hmm. You know, the closest thing I can get is to a dude who's wearing this outfit, but also with a cape and a fez. Like, I mean, no, it's like, seriously, like you're laughing, but seriously, that's the closest uniform that I can get to with it. And you know, and then all the other pictures are of these fatigues that I would expect to see on a battlefield, especially in the trenches
So
that's like, I guess that's another thing that I tend to look at. I mean, whether that has merit or not, that's something that I tend to look at when we're kind of analyzing these historic things as well, is, you know, is somebody who's going to be really in the trenches, is somebody who's honestly in the trenches getting shot in a war on the front lines gonna have a totally untainted uniform on?
Seems unlikely.
In all light colors. And that's one of those things that I guess.
And it's amazing they're all clean. If you notice everybody in those photos.
But I mean,
not
at least the like the other, the like the following photo where we're, say, it's from the same angle, but it's in like better view, blah, blah, blah. His fatigues are darker. They look like, you know, the pants are rolled up, the sleeves are rolled up. It looks worn. It looks real.
Yeah.
Versus the other one, which is why I was immediately like, oh, cool. There's like the real one and the staged one. But I mean, it looks like a muddy place that they're in. And the fact that his clothes are totally white. Crazy. I mean, that's crazy. I'm not saying that it proves anything or doesn't prove anything, but
in Spain, it would be dusty, but it wouldn't be muddy.
But it would be getting on their clothes.
It'd be dirty.
It'd be dirty. It wouldn't be this pristine white that it looks like in the film.
It looks like he had his mother wash his shirt and then he ran up the hill.
Right. But again, though, like, this isn't a definitive thing one way or the other, but that's something that always plays in my mind of looking at the clothes.
It could be like, you know, this makes it even more tragic, is that it was just his first day. He just came running up to the trench. Oh, I am here, senores, I'm here. Bang. And then he didn't even have time to go down and introduce himself. Yeah.
Well, he's in a lot of photos. He's in at least 4 different images that I saw of Robert Capa's from that day in that same series. So I think it's 4. There's 4 of 7 or 8 of that a series are available. And he is in at least 2. I take that back. He's actually in 2 or 3. He's not in every single one, but he's there in quite a few of them. But let's move into the last theory that we have,
because
this is a bit of an amalgamation of the theory that we've just been talking about, which is indeed the whole thing started out as a fake, and then it all got real.
Yeah.
And by that, how this theory goes is that yes, Kappa and Gerda are there. They're getting the soldiers to run this maneuver for them and show this stuff. What they don't realize is there is actually a small encampment of enemy soldiers nearby who, as they watch them doing their maneuvers and running around and jumping over the trenches and firing into the distance and yada, 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 think, what the hell? Why are they trying? I can't believe they know we're here and they're attacking us. And so they fight back. And it's during one of these feigned runs that Kappa is shooting photographs of that the man in the falling soldier image, who, by the way, we don't know who that man is yeah. to this day, but he is indeed hit by a bullet from an enemy that was, as yet until that point, unknown to be in the area.
Yeah, I kind of like that theory. That doesn't necessarily have to be like, oh, we were defending ourselves. It could be as simple as they had this kind of covert camp and...
They're
you
just
know.
Scouts, maybe.
They yeah, and they don't know. Yeah. And then the guys are like, oh, yeah, we're going to run all these training exercises. And they're like, wow, this is sniper fodder. Yeah. Cool.
The hard part is that there is... So there's a couple of problems with that. One is that Kappa interview, he talks about machine gun fire. But for a man to be hit like that with a machine gun, you got to be relatively close. So it can't be any kind of sniperish situation.
Who's that guy... Oh gosh, I can't remember. I think it might have been like CNN or Fox or something. He was like a news reporter. He was like a big.
Oh,
like
the one faking that he was in a foxhole?
No, he wasn't in a foxhole. He was like, ooh, our helicopter was shot down.
Oh, that was Brian Williams.
Yeah,
from
yeah.
NBC.
Yeah, yeah, NBC, yeah. And yeah. he was like, oh, we were shot down. I mean, this would not be the first time.
They got fire. They received fire.
Right, but this would not
like
be
that.
The first time that somebody who was a journalist inflated.
Oh, hell yeah.
The story. Behind an image, right? So, I mean, even if he was like, ooh, it was drills, and then this guy got shot down, he could have gone the extra step of saying, oh, and there was machine gun fire. It was awful. It was really dangerous.
The thing I find weird, though, is that Kappa didn't seem to be particularly tight-lipped about his stuff. He seemed to be a rather open, talkative guy in general, most of his stuff. And yet this particular one... He didn't talk a lot about, which is
that's the trick with lying. You know that,
well,
though,
but,
right?
Well, but that's what
don't
makes people think
it.
That, well, yeah. maybe that's why it's a fake, is that he didn't want to talk about it because it was fake. Or I've always wondered, well, what about as, you know, Joe made the joke earlier of, you know, somebody says pew, pew as you run and you fall and you die. And the first guy, they go pew, pew. And the first guy in the boiler suit falls down. And the second guy goes running. And instead of going pew, pew, somebody actually...
They go brat, brat.
Does actually pull the trigger and kill the guy. And then you're like, I've just witnessed a true to God murder. Because it was an accident. But it was murder.
Or not necessarily murder. It could have been a gun accident as is.
Yeah, it's like...
This guy's pointing a rifle, believe
it's friendly
unloaded.
Fire. Which yeah. way? Yeah. You don't want to tell the world that you got a famous photograph courtesy of friendly fire.
Well,
and nobody
but
wants
then
to talk about it. Let me finish. Is that here's the one really important thing. In that area where all of this is supposed to have taken place, you know, it was never reported until the 25th of September? Well, casualties.
Yeah.
Nobody was reported as having been killed in that entire time. So if it was friendly fire casualties, that's why you would cover that up and not report that guy missing
and
until later.
And that's all I was going to say was that, like, I feel like this is kind of that, like, double blind thing even though. Or, like, sometimes I was an expert liar as a child, I will tell you. So, like...
Well, we've been working with you for about 5 years now. We have figured out that you're an expert liar.
So the thing you do... is you convince yourself of the lie, right? You come up with, like, here's my backstory. And then you come up with your, like, okay, and then if this were my backstory, how would I react? And if I were reacting that way, how would I pretend to be reacting? Right?
Okay.
Are you following me?
Sort of.
Am I a crazy person?
She is really scripting this out, but I get
super
what...
But no, I'm saying that, like, okay,
but
so...
But that's how a good liar works.
Well, that's... I mean, and that may be, like, how... Robert Kappa was working is that, like, you know, he was like, all right, I staged all this stuff. This is great. If I want to keep this story going of this fake story, I have to act like it was real, that this person got shot in front of me. And what does a person who saw somebody get shot in front of them
trauma.
Act like?
It's a traumatic situation.
But yeah. I'm an outgoing person So I should be normally talking about it. So what is the way that me, a normally talking about a person, reacts to a... Yeah, right? So it's like that five-layer deep lie of... I don't know.
I get it.
It's not good.
I understand where you're going. It's not the best. It's not the worst.
It's not the worst.
And
that's the problem with this story, right?
And that's the hard part is that he does so much stuff in his life. He seems to be so willing to talk about most things. This is the thing that really kind of put him on the map, and you would really hate to tell the world, by the way, I know you love me now, but that first thing I did, that's totally a fake.
Yeah.
Because that is not how Oprah got her start, and that would destroy the Oprah empire. She's like, oh, and by the way, that first season was totally fake.
But on the other hand, you can also say, at 18, I took a picture of a person being killed in front of me. I watched somebody die.
It could be that, or it could be he was embarrassed because he didn't actually take the picture in a conscious way. He just stuck his camera, he said, up above the
trench wall. And it was luck. It was dumb luck.
And took a picture. He might have felt a little embarrassed about the fact that this is surely a random thing. It's supposedly like his greatest picture ever. And it's also his most random dumb luck picture ever.
And
doesn't mean
I don't give him any credit for it.
Right.
If he actually did take that picture, it's a real picture.
But I also wonder a little bit too if there's a little bit of guilt there with, like, again, you said this guy's never been identified.
Yeah, for many, many years, there was a lot of talk that the falling soldier was actually a famous Spanish revolutionary. It was then very conclusively proven. And by the way, Magnum and Waylon and everybody's like, oh, yeah, it's got to be him because of this information. But it's very conclusively proven that he died somewhere else. Because here's the other problem is that if we look at the landscape, it looks like it's fields. But the battle that it is said to have taken place in is in more of a mountainous, wooded area.
Sure.
And that guy was... They found his body against a tree in a wooded space. Sure. Like they know it's not him.
Yeah. But I guess I can also see the feeling of guilt of making your name on the death of somebody that you don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and the death of anybody.
Well, of course, if you're a war correspondent, you know, you probably ought to be used to that by now.
But if that was your first one.
That was your first maybe. Yeah.
At 18 years old. At 18, seeing somebody dying, taking a picture, and then suddenly you're famous because of it.
But I'm not sure that he saw the guy die. He stuck his camera up above the camera, took a picture, and he might not have even known for weeks that he even took that picture. I don't think he did.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, so, and I think this is why this is the story that we're covering, right?
So there's so many different things. We haven't done this in a while, but I want to do this. I want to do a very quick round table, 4 or 5 sentence reason. What do you think? What is your preferred answer? So I'm going to start with you, Joe.
Preferred answer. Okay, my preferred answer is that it probably was staged, and I don't totally blame him for doing it because, again, he probably at a certain point you get frustrated. Like I said, you keep trying to catch that special little moment. You never do. Finally, you say, screw it. You, pose for a picture. I don't blame him.
Okay.
I don't.
Okay.
Definitely. Unfortunately, I agree. I do feel like it's staged. I hate that you're actually counting on your fingers how many sentences I'm saying.
That was number 3.
I know. I think it was staged, unfortunately, because it's not real. It's just not. It's not, but that's not to diminish the experiences that he had or the talent that he had.
Yes.
But it is just to say that this particular photo was fake, like his name and his wife's name or his name.
Yeah, his girlfriend.
Yeah.
Gerda. Yeah, no, I feel like it. I also agree that I think that it was a staged photo, and it kills me to say that because did you guys watch any of the documentaries on him? Did you get a chance to do that outside of the specific topic?
No.
It's one of those things you do when, I mean, we always ask each other, did you watch this completely unrelated?
Yeah. Nah.
Okay. I've been watching documentaries on the man, and his imagery, like, I saw it at first. He's talented. I didn't get it at first. I did not get the things that he saw. Like, I do this with a lot of photographers. So I want it to be real. And I see all of the body of... He had 70 or 700,000 images he left behind. Like, it is an amazing breadth of work, and I hate to think that it was all leveraged off of a falsification, but I cannot say that I feel that it wasn't anymore. By the way, if you go out there, there's a 2003 documentary made on it. Please, somebody find an original copy of that and put it on the internet, because there is one on YouTube that is great. It's like an hour and 20 some minutes long, but some jackass has hacked it up and spliced it out of order. And so it's like 45 minutes, and then it jumps around. Well, like, it's confusing as hell.
Realistically, that's probably the way that they've gotten past
around
the patent.
Copyright issue. Yeah. Yes, I know, but it's still.
Yeah. You got to download it and re-splice it.
But here's,
Well, here's what I'll say is that he would not be the first artist ever to make his name on a fake or forgery.
There's recent war correspondents who've been found out
and
do the same thing in Photoshop.
Like, genuinely historic. I mean, like, we talk about Thomas Edison, a super famous dude who stole literally everything that he ever did, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that it takes away from his talent.
No. I agree.
But
he's incredibly talented.
But unfortunately...
But it is an unfortunate... start we now know, but it did not stop his career.
It could have been actually a very auspicious start, because maybe his reasoning was, and I could sort of see this, it's like, I really want to be able to go out and do this, take all these pictures so everybody around the world can see what's going on out here in the battlefield. But unfortunately, I really can't afford to do it.
No.
I've got to go out there and I've got to take some killer picture that'll put me on the map, and then I'll get those higher fees.
Yeah.
And then I'll be able to do this. Yeah, you know,
no, I mean, he was the only photographer on Omaha Beach on D-Day.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have those images. There's images from when he, the year that he died, when he was in the Indochina War.
Yeah.
I mean, I stopped, I paused the video, I looked at it. It is beautiful with soldiers walking in line. There's tank, there's dust, there's a sunset. This is all in black and white, remember. There's no color. And it is striking imagery.
It's beautiful.
So he did a fantastic job.
Yeah.
And I would recommend that everybody go out and look at Kappa's work.
Yeah.
We will, of course, have the image of the falling soldier on the website. Mm. I will also put up as a secondary link the comparison photo that I've made, the animated GIF that is rotating, so you can see them overlaid on each other, because it really helps explain what we've talked about so far.
Agree.
That is all going to be on our website, which is thinkingsidewayspodcast.com. There'll be a couple of other research links on there, as always, and then you can listen to and download the episode from there. On the website, you're also going to find the episode list as a separate page, and then you'll also find links to merchandise, so hats, mugs, coffee cups, shirts, all that. No hats. Actually, no hats. Shirts and all that kind of stuff.
How come we don't have a hat?
Because embroidery is expensive, it turns out. So that stuff is all on the website. Now, if you don't want to just listen to and download through the website, you can always go to any of the streaming services. So if you get your podcasts through Apple, you can go ahead and subscribe and leave us a rating. We appreciate that, and that helps others find us. We're also on other streaming services, so our good friends at Stitcher have us, so you can always find us on Stitcher. We are all over social media, so we have the Facebook page and the Facebook group. So the page is where we put episodes and other fun stuff, and then the group is where the episode discussions will happen.
Mm-hmm.
There's also episode discussions that happen on our subreddit, so you can look that up.
Yep.
And then we have a couple other places. We have Twitter, where there's some conversations and fun stuff going.
Yep.
And then Instagram, where we're putting other weird fun
stuff.
Who
knows
so
what?
There's all kinds of fun, weird stuff coming from Thinking
Sideways.
You
can connect with all of us.
Absolutely. And remember, on Instagram, it is not Thinking Sideways, it's Thinking Sideways Podcast.
Link to it from our Facebook or our website, you'll get to the right spot.
You will.
Yeah.
And of course, if you questions, comments, stories you want to suggest, you can reach out and give those to us directly through our email, which is thinkingsidewayspodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah.
It takes us a little bit these days to get back, but we're always trying to get back to people as quickly as we can. So if it doesn't happen on day one, I apologize, but we're doing our best That thing is always full.
It's literally us three literally responding to everything.
And
we don't have a team.
A couple of dozen interns.
We still need to hire that out. We still need to get an intern.
All right, we should call Justin again.
Yeah. God, I mean, his podcast doesn't do anything.
No.
I think that is all that I have to say about this particular mystery. It's all laid out there in black and white. So we will talk to you guys next week.
Fake but real.
I'm sorry for the successfully nerdy episode.
Bye.